Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. This is a live call-in show, if you're listening live and not archived. And the number to call in is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. If you need a toll-free line, the number to call is The number to call if you need a toll-free line is area code 855-346-3351. 855-346-3351. Okay, so it's been a couple of days since I've been on. Things have been hectic in La La Land. And I am just wondering what you've been up to. People have been wanting to know where I've been, so I've been all over the place and trying to get back on a hold on what's going on in the news, in the current events. So tonight's show is an open lines, anything goes show. And if you have something that you'd like to talk about, now would be a great time to call in. There was an article that came out on August 2nd, which I believe is today, in the New York Times. California's Department of Correction and Rehabilitation has introduced new policies for the use of force against mentally ill prisoners that are among the most detailed in the nation, the article says. The changes, which were introduced on Friday, were set into motion after video showed corrections officers in state prisons dousing severely mentally ill inmates with pepper spray and forcibly removing them from their cells. The videos drew public outrage and were called horrific by a federal judge who ordered the footage made public last year. The department said the revised policies filed in federal district court on Friday in response to an order issued by Judge Lawrence K. Carlton in April represented, quote, a system-wide culture change in how correctional staff members deal with mentally ill prisoners. The corrections department worked to revise the policies with a special master appointed... I'm sorry. The corrections department worked, it's not funny. The corrections department worked to revise the policies with a special master appointed by, I can't. Right, is anybody out there listening to me? 267-521-0167. As I talk about the special master appointed by the court, the article says, and consulted on the revisions with lawyers for the plaintiffs in a long-running lawsuit over the state's treatment of mentally ill prisoners that led to the judge's order. The New York Times article continues, the increasing number of mentally ill prisoners in prisons and jails across the country. In 2013, mentally ill prisoners made up just over 28% of California's prison population. You know, there was a great quote in the DuBois Research Project from somebody who was diagnosed and assigned while in prison. And he said that he didn't know that he had any mental troubles, and that, quote, prison kind of brought that out in me. And so this rise in, you know, quote, unquote, things that are psychiatric, perhaps maybe looking at the environments that people are in might have something to do with it also. But anyway, the article continues that this... mentally ill prisoners made up just over 28% of California's prison population has raised questions about their treatment and correction systems poorly equipped to deal with psychiatric symptoms. Again, not really addressing the idea that maybe the prisons themselves are creating these traumatic experiences, which are then causing people to not score well on these very subjective testing instruments, so to speak. Okay, so the thing that makes me most nerve-wracked about this entire thing is that it's, you know, the part of it is toward eliminating the use or the amount of time or the need for who can be put into solitary confinement, which, of course, is torture and needs to be banned regardless of whether or not you've been psychiatrically labeled, that nobody should be able to be put in solitary confinement. But it says, the policy also states that mentally, this is a quote, that mentally ill inmates no longer need to be forcibly extracted from their cells to be given medication or other treatment, as was routinely done in the past, but can be treated where they are. This must be some kind of like Olmstead for prisons kind of a thing. I'm not sure. This is just, this is so nauseating to me. The idea that that there's now no, while being forcibly extracted from their cells, which is the words that they are used, a cell extraction, now they can be treated with medication, quote-unquote medication, in their cell. There's no need to have them removed from their cell. They can be treated right in their cell. And therefore, there's one less process that needs to be gone through in order to do this. So that's very much concerning to me. If you are wanting to talk, the number is area code 267-521-0167. I'm not sure if you're trying to get through, but 617, your line is open.
Thank you. I was. It's Julie. I'm not really calling from Massachusetts.
Oh, okay. Hi, Julie. Hi,
thank you. Yes, I just tried to post a message to you trying to let you know it was me calling, but I'm not really calling from Massachusetts. It's just a Massachusetts number. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate this. Yeah, that's funny. They put people in prison, and who's to say? I would think they put somebody in prison that they're going to arbitrarily call them mentally ill or not. It's kind of arbitrary, right?
Yeah.
Anyway,
right.
Mental hospitals are prisons. Anyway, I mean, I don't know, you're stuck in the mental hospital, you're going to get depressed. I mean, they're locking you up, right?
Right.
It's pretty
exactly. Depressing.
I mean, gee. I wrote a list, and I said to myself, well, what I was listening to one of your other shows, and I said, wow, I totally agree with the stuff you're saying about the changes in the movement and everything. You know, I've been around for a while, and and I was looking back over things, and I said, well, what's the funniest mental health situation I've ever been in? And, wow, some of them were really funny, but I thought, boy, maybe when I was in, well, for one thing, people think I was always rebellious. Well, maybe, yeah. That's my character. But I was fully compliant for 30 years. I was fully compliant for 30 years, very, very proud of myself for being fully compliant, had all those meds memorized, and had the dosages memorized. I could spell them better than the doctors could. Of course I could. I could spell them so well. And the doctors were just so amazed. Oh, you have your meds memorized? Really? You're capable of that? You know, and... You know, I used to go, you know, I remember, you know, 2011 showing up at an emergency room and the nurse asking me, how do you spell that? And I had to spell it out for her. And, you can spell, huh? Yeah, I'm college educated. Oh, you are, huh? Yeah, I got a master's degree. But anyway, being in day treatment, this was like around 1990. And they encouraged me to collect stuffed animals. So I had about 100 of them, had all the names of them memorized, and I would have them talk to each other. They encouraged this. So I had this collection of them. I'd have them talk to each other, which they encouraged. And they encouraged all the clients to carry stuffed animals around with them. So you had a bunch of childlike people talking to their stuffed animals, carrying them around, crying with their stuffed animals, carrying pillows around and baby blankets. And, yeah, sure enough, you know, yeah, it got pretty funny. And so I had all these stuffed animals in my apartment. And I thought to myself, well, gee, I grew up with these wonderful, wonderful books, wonderful books. When I walked out from the USA, I left 700 books behind, but I do remember The Wizard of Oz. You know, and I studied a lot of literature when I was in graduate school, but I had to read like 60 or 70 books. And but The Wizard of Oz sticks in my mind as one of those childhood books. And what was it? Well, this Dorothy, that was my grandmother's name. Dorothy walked with three kooks for a very, very, very long distance along this very colorful, wacky road with these three nuts. And these three nuts, you know, they had these diseases, and they went to this wizard who was a fake. And the fake, what did he do? He wrote scripts. He wrote scripts basically for the fakes, for the kooks, with these kind of weird diseases. And they walked away satisfied. They weren't cured, but they were satisfied, so they were happy. Because they were satisfied because he wrote these scripts based on guesswork. But he couldn't solve Dorothy's real problem. but she had a loud mouth, and she called him a humbug because that's what he was. He's not really a wizard, which we all knew. You know. And she called him out. And after that, there was something to do with Ruby Slippers or something. But I just love that story. There's no place like home. There's no place like home. There's no place like home. And it's so beautiful. And you know, I grew up with that, and so did a million, zillion, trillion other kids. And, you know, there's so many myths, and you got to break them apart and just show people that, you know, geez, we're real smart here. But I don't have any stuffed animals. I got this person that hasn't spoken a word for 7 years. She got some terrible disorder. She's underweight too. She's below the weight that my doctor would treat a person. She would dump all her patients that were under that weight. You know something? She's a dog. But nobody asked her. Somebody better go and ask her, you know. I don't know. I'm glad I'm a writer. They tried to stop me from writing.
They tend to do those things about limiting people's dreams and preventing them.
Yeah. They do that. They told me to. They told me I didn't belong in graduate school, and tried to stop me from that too. And I. They told me if I didn't go to day treatment instead, I would never make it in life. I told them to go screw, and I went back to graduate school. I can laugh about that one too. So yeah.
That's really, really something. Would you share what you have a couple of books, right?
Yeah, I had a couple that are published, and I wrote seven, which they told me I could never do.
Right.
The funny thing is, I don't know what else. Another thing that's really funny is, you know, afterward, you know, comparing notes, because at McLean Hospital, there's this really, really big, revered doctor, and afterward, comparing notes and finding out that anybody that walks into his office gets automatically diagnosed with his favorite diagnosis, which is borderline personality disorder. What I was really suffering from at the time when I walked into his office or his, wherever it was, meeting room, was too much shock treatments. And I'd been shocked about 30 or 40 times, I guess. It's probably written down on, you know, my schedule book. And, 30 or 40 times, I said the last two-thirds of them were double-sided by Dr. Michael Henry, who isn't at McLean Hospital anymore. He was very shock happy. And my late boyfriend, he's been dead 11 years now, nearly to the day. He would tell them, Julie is getting more and more confused. Please stop shocking her. And I could barely talk. I could barely stand up, in fact. And he kept saying, please, no more shock. Please stop. And they said, no. The confusion is a sign of depression. And he said, no, I don't think so. I think she's getting more confused from the shock. Please stop. And they said, no, bring her in. She'll be better. And he would tell me, Julie, this is breaking my heart. I can't stand to see you shocked like this. We're going to have to get them to stop. And finally they did. But I was a mess for the next year and a half. And they'd ask me, they'd tell me, you're faking psychosis. And I'd say, I don't know what's wrong, but I can't put a thought together. I can't put a sentence together. And they said, you're faking it. So we think you have borderline personality disorder, a very severe case of it.
Unbelievable.
They forced that kind of treatment on me. And
really?
until the confusion wore off. And that was my 1996 and 1997. And finally that confusion wore off while they accused me of faking it and tried to send me to the state hospital because they said I was incurably borderline personality disorder. And I almost got sent to the state hospital.
And you went through.
I don't laugh.
You went through a lot of institutionalizations, right?
I did. I went through over 50, because I thought it was all great. I thought they were curing me, but meanwhile I had this eating disorder. That's what I really had all the time. I never had anything else. But they didn't know back in 19, I had it for like a year, and I don't believe for a minute that eating disorders are mental at all. Yeah, I've been through depression. I have been through horrible depression too. But I still have it. I mean, it never was resolved, but I had an eating disorder. It descended upon me very suddenly. At the age of 22, and it was inherited, and it's a nutritional problem that would very well have been solved had I not gone to mental health.
Uh-huh.
And, if you're dealing with these terrible nutritional problems, you're going to get depressed.
Right.
I also went through depression as a teenager, which is, kind of a normal thing, and it was, I dealt with it.
And a lot of trauma, right? I mean,
Yeah, I did. I've dealt with quite a bit of trauma in my life, and many people do. But I've dealt with quite a bit. Most of the trauma has been psychiatric abuse.
Okay.
Psychiatric abuse and quite a bit of psych abuse, especially the past 6 years, especially. And I would say the worst of it, the worst of it has been the past 6 years, certainly. You would think that, the earlier years, like the 80s, the worser hospitals, back then, they were worse, but they weren't. And, in many ways they were nicer back then because, I don't know. Some of them were worse and some of them were better. But, nowadays, it's, they've tightened the security and they think you're more dangerous. And, it's nastier and, plus the poverty is set in. And, I think plus being, Trips are just with the electronic records is also a tough thing too. HIPAA is not followed.
No.
And the fact that psychiatry is more mainstream, more socially acceptable, that you go to a shrink, more seen as the norm, more seen as good, and people are less skeptical of psychiatry, that makes it tough because I'm more seen as a criminal and more seen as this dangerous bad person, but I'm certainly not.
No. Right, and certainly if something like H.R. 3717 passes,
right,
with the way that mm-hmm. just slashes at HIPAA and privacy rights.
I'm trying to figure out, I've just contacted my publisher because I'm just trying to figure out, like, what I'm going to write for my next book, and it's really tough because I've got so many options at this point, you know. Is it going to be an eating disorders focus? Is it going to be, you know, something else? Because, I just don't know because, or is it going to be humor? Because it's just so darn funny. I mean, how on earth they just, the blunders are just so screamingly funny. And, you know, I could just do a fiction thing and just fictionalize my whole thing and just make it really, really, really funny. And because it just show how funny it really is and just make people laugh. I just don't know. And I just don't know.
I'm wondering if you'd like to tell people about how they can reach you. I know you have a couple of websites, so you have both the WordPress.
The WordPress blog is the one that just has kind of, like, I've put the most into it. It's juliemattblogger.wordpress.com. I keep thinking of taking it off of wordpress.com, but I think I probably won't. They seem to be rather okay about free speech on wordpress.com. And I even wrote to them and I said, hey, if I mention individual people, such as the names of the doctors, you know, are you going to take me off? And they said, no, we believe in free speech. Because I'm out of the country, and the police aren't going to come knocking on my door here. Should I do such a thing? And I've done it. I went ahead and did it. I went and named my doctors, named the ones that did the wrong, screwed up things. I did it. And the police, you know, nobody here is going to bother me. Because had I lived in the States at the time, yeah, they would have done it. They were police, you know, the police, the town cops in the town that I lived in, they would have been right knocking on my door, criminalizing me and taking me away. You would have heard my dog barking for about 3 minutes, thinking that she'd never see me again, ever. Ever. Yeah, that's heartbreaking. You can hear me on the marathon, the marathon site, talking about that, how my dog thinks when I'm taken away that she'll never, ever, ever see me again. Because once I had a tape recorder running when the cops came, and they took me away, and I don't have the tape recording of the cops, but I have her. I'm put that up publicly because that's illegal, but I have her barking. The sound of her barking on that tape is the most heartbreaking sound you ever heard, and it's up there on the marathon site put up by Northeastern University. I don't think it's ever been listened to. Because they put up about 1,000 things up there. But my piece is up there. It's an MP3 file of my writings. I had written something actually the day after the race. I went to the gym and ran. I think I ran about 5K at the gym, and then I wrote some pieces a few days after. And then I read them on an MP3 file, and I had in the background a recording of of my dog barking after right after I had been taken away. It was just kind of a serendipity that I had a tape recorder running. And I put that up there. It's hard for me hearing her.
It just kind of chews her hair hard out. And where can people find that marathon?
I think it's mymarathon.com. It's on there somewhere. I think it's under my real name. I'm pretty sure. I have it listed in my blog, but it's not right up. It's not. I don't have it in the sidebar. I should probably put it in the sidebar, but it's listed on my blog somewhere. It's really been disorganized since my kidneys failed over the summer. It's been hard for me to get things organized.
And you have a lot because you've got a lot of videos, a lot of writing, a lot of blogs.
I just got everything. I've got everything. I write every day. I write all the time. I just write constantly, really. It's not the only thing I can do. They told me it's useless. Here's another funny thing. They told me, I was told around July of about a year ago, you have a useless master's degree. This is a mental health professional, a PhD, a mental health professional told me that you have a useless master's degree and you should get a day job. You should get a day job. I'm gonna laugh at that then. Because
they really just take away everything.
They take away everything. Yeah. A few days later, I went to the town telling them that our public housing building had had no hot water for over 6 months. Well, it was spotty. It was like 10% of the time we had hot water. The rest of the time we didn't. At least the lower floors didn't that I knew of. And could they please do something about it? And I have that piece of writing tacked up in my blog as well. And it's called We Are Not Worthless People. God bless writing. I was in a state of severe starvation at the time. This was August 1st. And I was thin as a rail. I staggered to the town hall. I handed them that piece of writing, stuck it on their desk, and I said, we haven't had hot water in about 8 months. And I stuck her this piece of writing called, We Are Not Worthless People. She says to me, do you want me to call this an official complaint? I said, yes, barely getting this out of my mouth, walked back to my building, said to myself, I'm a hero. And I said, if this is the last thing I do, if I die tomorrow, I've gotten us hot water. Because they turned on the hot water half hour later. And it was on ever since. To my knowledge, it's still on at that building now. I'm across the equator now. No one even knew I did it. I got them hot water because of writing. Because of writing. And I said, if I die tomorrow, I've done this.
The pen is mightier than the sword.
I coded in the emergency room of kidney failure. And they abused me in the hospital. They abused me in the hospital. Now, that's ironic. They abused me in the hospital.
I mean, it's just so inhumane that's even a sentence.
It's offensive.
The debacle of it.
So, they're going to drug me to stop me from writing. So, hey, I just like, hell. Anybody gonna insult me? Well, I feel so much better than I did 2 years ago, and I feel like I got a better life. I got a better life, and anybody gonna insult me? Well, the heck with it. Today I made a decision. I'm getting off Facebook, and I got a three step way to get better, and I've seen it followed for since around the time I told McClain to go screw in 19. I think around the end of 1997. So, when I went to college.
Uh-huh.
Instead of the state hospital, and started my first novel.
Right.
That
one. Just a different kind of institutionalization, right?
Number one, remove yourself from oppression. Number two, obtain temporary assistance. It must be temporary. I've reworded that one a few times. Number three, restore dignity. That's all you got to do. I've seen plenty of people do that three-step thing. That's all you got to do. That's all you got to do. You can get well from anything. You can get well from anything.
So remove yourself. So your three things, Robin. Remove yourself from oppression.
Obtain temporary assistance.
Obtain temporary assistance.
Right. I think I've reworded that a bunch of times. And the third is restore dignity. Restore dignity. Yeah.
Dignity, which is routinely stolen, right? So easily.
Yeah, it was stolen. It gets stolen, yeah. And, you know, restore dignity for me was, you know, that's often, you know, getting an education or writing a book or, you know, getting friends or falling in love or, for some people it's gardening or building your body or doing sports or, having a baby, things, many things. Education for a lot of people, going to college or, getting a good job and doing a really good job at raising,
I think that these are really important things that, that people are in many ways detracted from doing when they're involved with the system in any level. And, the idea that you can get out and you can do things and you can change it around is important for people to know.
Yes.
And to be able to talk about. I think it's crucially important.
Yes. And the oppression, it can be many kinds of oppression. It can be being inside a hospital, inside a terrible marriage, a very bad job, very bad halfway house that's just stifling, or, very bad parents situation, living situation that's just not good for you. Nursing homes. Oh, I've heard about terrible nursing homes or, a lot of times it's the living situation, but sometimes it's not. Or a school situation, a bullying situation, or a lot of times it's psychiatric abuse, and you just got to get away from that awful therapist or, a doctor that's just needling at you. In the case of eating disorders, a person can be in a very, very, very bad treatment situation that, Jesus, you just can't get out of it, and you can't get out of it, you just got to walk away. And I was in a terrible treatment situation. That therapist was threatening me. Oh, it was terrible. I'd walk in that office, she'd threaten, and I walked away. And no, it wasn't all roses when I left. And that was another myth I had to dump because, I thought, well, gee, if I walk away from her, everything's going to be great. But it wasn't. And, there wasn't that great job with MIA waiting for me, sitting for me, and I wasn't always suddenly famous, and I didn't suddenly see colors and have a million friends. It wasn't like that at all. I had nothing and nobody, and everybody hated me when I walked away from her. And, everybody hated me, and I had nothing. I had no conversation for months on end, and that was awful. It was two very, very, very dark years for me. And, you know, it just about ended with my demise, but a year ago, but it's been a dark hole, but not because I walked away, but because of her and because of people's misconception, really. People's, like, very bad misconception, and because I was so traumatized and shaken by everything that happened. And because of their denial of abuse. They flat out denied it. Everybody assumed, oh, the doctors must be right and Julie must be crazy. But I wasn't. Of course I wasn't. And very, very slowly, it's opening up and people saying, wait a minute, she's right. That little crazy girl with the dog is right. She knows what she's talking about. And very slowly, people are realizing, wait a minute, me too, me too, me too. And people are just starting to, like, say, hey, wait a minute. And she's not so bad. She's not a criminal. She's actually funny. Actually. Use that word. Actually. She's actually funny. She's actually not a criminal. Maybe she was pissed off for a reason, and she's actually smart. Oh, yeah. And he's actually funny. Maybe she really was pissed off for a reason. And, you know, hey. And,
It really is unnerving when you start to unpack it and see how many people they do this to repeatedly, the same way over and over again. And maintains hopeful that there are ways to get out. So how did you get out?
Well, I draw a parallel between walking out of the mental health system and very, very kind of I model it with my walking out of a religious cult at the age of 21. I was 10 days in a religious cult, the Moonies, and I was in that for when I was on a hitchhiking trip, and it's the exact parallel of my adventures, my 30 plus years adventure with the mental health system, because I was entirely duped by it, entirely taken in by this cult. I thought it was wonderful. And then it kind of went sour toward the end of the 10 days. Wow, did it ever. It was kind of didn't seem right anymore. And I also said, whoa, and I woke up, and I started trying to tell everybody about it in secret. And I started to try to pass notes to people and say, hey, we got to get out, we got to get out. But they caught me out at it, and one day, like, right kind of quietly got me out of there. They quietly got me out of there and dumped me off at a train station at 3 a.m. They didn't quite do it the same as the psychiatric system did, which was to shut me up and lock me up and drug me to death. Try to, anyway. But yeah, the same thing happened. A light bulb went off in my head, and I figured it out all by myself. I figured it out. No one told me. I didn't read a book. I didn't, I was abused just a little bit too badly. There was the shock, too much shock in 1996, which, you know, that was kind of like too much. And then, then I guess 5 years passed. Okay, then I was handed. I had a decent therapist. The one therapist in over 20 that was decent. So things were okay. And then she said, "Wait a minute, Joe. You don't even have all these other disorders. What you really have is an eating disorder. And they shouldn't have given me to you." And I said, "But listen, you're really a decent human being." And she actually had tears in her eyes, and she said, "You really have an eating disorder. You shouldn't have been given all this treatment." But anyway, meanwhile, I was like nearly graduating with my bachelor's degree, which I got summa cum laude. And all of a sudden, my boyfriend died, And I realized, wait a minute, what are these medications doing to me? And right before he died, we had this discussion. I said, why am I gaining all this weight? And he said, Jules, maybe it's the meds. And, So by in 2005, I was double the weight I should have been. And, I couldn't walk anymore because my knees couldn't take it. And I was taking, you know, I know some of your listeners know the meds, so 900 milligrams of Seroquel, 900 milligrams of Seroquel. Yeah.
Wow.
And so naturally, I gained 50 pounds in 50 pounds in 6 months. 50 pounds in 6 months. And I'm 5'1". Go figure. So, of course, my knees couldn't tolerate that. I couldn't walk anymore. I couldn't stand. I couldn't even walk using a walker because my knees couldn't take it. I used using a wheelchair. I couldn't fit in the wheelchair anymore. I had broken the arms of the wheelchair. They wouldn't stick to the screws had fallen off. You can laugh. Go ahead, laugh. It's funny.
No, it's not funny.
Yes, it wasn't my wheelchair. It wasn't my wheelchair. So I was embarrassed because the arms had kind of popped off. I'm laughing because it was a while back, and I might as well because I'm going to cry if I don't laugh. And I didn't have any friends, so I didn't have any transportation to get to the doctor to find out what was wrong with my knee, so I just stayed at home. I didn't have anyone to talk to, and so I just stayed home and couldn't go anywhere. And had to hire a dog walker. And so the weeks passed and other months passed, and there I was in the wheelchair. And, I guess finally, my psychiatrist was on a cozy little maternity leave. And so she comes waltzing back from maternity leave having pumped iron at the gym. And so she's coming back, and she's pumped iron, pumped off all her baby weight. And so she waltzes in and says, Julie, I'm hobbling in on my walker. And I'm about to tell her, well, you know, you got to get me off this Seroquel. I don't know, maybe I was already off it and trying to, like, desperately, like, hey. I don't know, man. I couldn't walk on the walker, and I think I was like on the verge of getting off circle. I can't remember. She says to me, "Julie, I didn't know you use a walker now." you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
You see what I'm saying? She's like, you know, this is your fate. This is your fate because you got to accept your fate because you're on these medications, and this is your weight's just going to go up and up, and that's your fate. And then a few years later, she told me how happy I was on Seroquel. So you can see where this was headed. I began to rebel. I began to rebel big time. And part of that rebellion was anorexia nervosa. When I went off Seroquel, my weight plummeted. And it halved, and more so. And she told me it was refusal to grow up. You can laugh. Go ahead. You can laugh. But, you know, what can I say? I began to campaign as, please put a black box warning on this Seroquel. Don't give it to people who have a history of an eating disorder. Please.
Yeah.
Never. Never. Because it's going to backfire. Because then after that, I met 7 people, I think, who had Seroquel backfire. Their anorexia came back after the Seroquel weight gain from Seroquel or a similar weight gaining antipsychotic.
Right. Any one of them, sure. Mm. That would only.
Yeah.
7 only.
Never mind the wreckage that it did. You know.
Diabetes. You know, all those things.
And so, you know, I was still fully compliant. Of course I was. And I switched to Thorazine, and that gave me TD. And I was beginning to get the tonsing, and I was beginning to get the tonsing. It's gone. It's gone. It went away. We got off the Thorazine, but and see, then I was getting the TD from the Risperdal. And then one day I got incarcerated in an emergency room. They forgot to give me all my meds. They forgot. I told them I was compliant. I told them what my meds were, but they forgot. So I said, well, I'm not going to take those antipsychotics anymore. And I didn't. That's when I stopped them.
Well, what a surviving story.
Yeah. And, you know, I what can I say? The abuse just got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And I'm shocked that I was compliant for so many years. So many years. And I'm shocked that I'm alive, because they would say to me, you tolerate the meds so well, I'll give you more. We'll give you more because you tolerate them so well. But I never needed them. They would just say, well, you tolerate them, so we'll give you more. And I would say they helped, but they didn't really, but I thought that would please them if I said they helped. And I felt like I belonged and I was special because it was this different world and it was somehow good to belong to this thing, but I don't know. After a while, it just didn't seem all that great. And there was that girl that composed music. She was forgotten. And I was really, really talented as a music composer, but I got forgotten along the way. And, you know, what happened to that girl? What happened to her? The girl that hitchhiked around the country with her dog, she's gone. She's gone and forgotten about. Everybody forgot about me. And that makes me very sad. It does. And what happened to her? And I look back, and it's all gone. And they it's just gone. And I got very sad sometimes. So,
sometimes there are things to be sad about, unfortunately. That's a reality I don't think any of us get to get around. But the needless suffering it causes, the absolute torture and pain that it inflicts on people, it really is criminal.
Yeah, I'm really proud of myself to get off Facebook at this point, because they just insult me so much that, When I read Laura's article, it came out September 10th, last year. I thought, well, gee, if my walking away from mental health is going to make me just like Laura, I'll be popular and loved, and I'll get a job at MIA, and everybody's going to love me. I'll be just like Laura, and I'll see colors again. It didn't happen that way. That's a big myth. If you walk away from mental health, you'll be loved and followed and have a million likes, and you'll even refuse your email because you'll be so busy. It's not true.
Yeah, I don't think that's true.
Most people are hated just like me. Most people are hated just like me, and you're not popular. You won't get a job at MIA. Very few people are in that inner circle, and most people a lot of people are homeless. A lot of people have been worse, and it's a long, slow road if you ever make it, if you even live. And, you know, I don't want to discourage people, but if you stay in mental health, you're probably not going to live either. I mean, I encourage
it's a terrible catch, but I think, I say that pretty often. Just because I reject psychiatry doesn't mean that any issues that I had in my life have now disappeared. And I think that there's plenty of, you know, but however, I think I do firmly believe that if I didn't reject psychiatry, I would have more problems now than I do.
Exactly. No, I think.
Do you know what I mean? I think.
If you reject psychiatry, I think anybody who rejects psychiatry early on is going to be very well off. I mean, if you go, the longer you stay in psychiatry, you know, the more damage is going to be done. The sooner you reject them and the sooner you get out, the better off you are. The longer you stay in, you know, there's more damage.
And I think it's definitely a it's definitely an evolving kind of thing. And so, you know, and not everybody has work all the time. So I never begrudge people who have work in the work that they have. But the idea that if you do this, then somehow you're going to get this life where you get to do these things. I mean, there are only so many positions that really give people that kind of flexibility in the world.
Precisely.
Right? Not only that, but
there are people, I mean, it's, I know you have to get out carefully. You do have to get out carefully because there is retaliation. There certainly is. And if you have family, great. Great. That's a very, very good thing. And that's fantastic. But, you know, I had nothing when I walked out. Nothing. And, you know, start from scratch pretty much. And people that still have their families, that's fantastic. But, you know, the sooner you can walk out, the better. And people have varying ways of doing it, varying very creative ways of walking out. That's fantastic. I would encourage anyone to do it any way. And if there's any way that I can help somebody walk out and be of assistance, great. And walking out of psychiatry doesn't mean just stopping meds. I don't think therapy is a good thing. I don't think therapy is a good thing. No, not at all. I don't believe in the principle of it. Go to somebody, pay them to talk to them. That's prostitution. Pay them for conversation. Pay a person to be your friend. That's prostitution. I mean, I used to walk to this lady's office, dread walk into her office. She threatened me. She'd accuse me of throwing up in the bathroom, which I don't do. And she'd tell me she was going to send me to the state hospital, tell me if my weight dropped too low, she accused me of lying about my weight, accused me of throwing up all the time, accused me of drinking a lot of water as manipulation without realizing that lithium makes you very, very, very thirsty even if you took it way in the past. Because it affected my kidneys, lied to me about my medical condition. She was manipulative. It worked with her sectioning. She would threaten the state hospital just every single time I walked in there. I had an eating disorder, and she she denied that I'd been abused in these hospitals. That woman was on a power trip, an unbelievable power trip. I know she's done stuff to other patients.
Right.
Unbelievable. Never should practice. Somebody should just take the license away from her. I was in shock and I was like PTSD'd after I got away from that woman. I shouldn't even call it D. PTSD.
Yeah, I mean, I think that historically psychiatry does do a phenomenal amount of damage, and currently doing it, and they're setting it up to do so in the future and to just continue.
They're going to force it on people. With the Murphy bill, you're going to force it on people. And, you know, I think the therapy, the mentality of therapy is worse than the drugging, because they tell you, you need us. You need us. And it encourages bad behaviors. And people with eating disorders, you know, I know the eating disorder work because I lived with an eating disorder that I had was misdiagnosed for 30 years. And I know that people with eating disorders flirt with death. They almost, I finally got into eating disorders treatment, which is this new thing. It's a new thing since the 90s. But I got into it in 2010 finally and found out the reality of what it really is. It's terrible. It's inhumane, unbelievable torture. Unbelievable torture. As soon as I, found out what it is, and it's really bad. Force feeding is torture, and it's not good at all. And those are places. Oh my God, they tear down the walls, man. But the kids will. It's not their fault. It's not their fault. They almost die and come back to life, but they're rescued. They're rescued. They fall back on the rescuers. They fall back on the rescuers time after time after time. And they go running back to those rescuers, which are this eating disorders treatment, time after time after time. And I see it over and over. Now what happens is it's not their fault. It's the fault of the rescuers that, you know, they're very manipulative. Come back, come back, come back. They suck them back in, force them back into this manipulative treatment. It's very manipulative, very controlling. We're going to force weigh you, force blind weight you, get you on the scale, force them on the scale, bully them to death about over their weight. And these kids are scared to death. They're scared. Some of them didn't even have eating disorders in the first place. And they're terrified. They're absolutely terrified. And they're watched in the bathroom, watched constantly. Their privacy is taken away. Their dignity is stolen from them. They're watched while they eat. Watched. Oh, my God. Their piss is looked at. Even if they have their periods. And
Dehumanization in the worst way. And for people who be familiar with psychiatry, who may just be stumbling over this thing, to understand that this is really part of what happens and part of why things like the Murphy Bill, H.R. 3717, need to be stopped dead in their tracks.
Let me tell you what it's like to sit in an eating disorders ward. You hear the constant sound of slurping, which is the sound of the feeding tube feeding a person. That sound becomes the sound of your life. And when you have a feeding tube stuck into your nose, when you eat something, it goes yank, yank, yank right into you. Try having one of those in you for, some people have them in for a couple of months. And you cannot control what they put into that bag. And I know, when I was on that ward, I had flatulence 24/7 while that feeding tube was in me.
just to contextualize this historically, one of the things that stuck out in my head of the Opal, the journal that was written by the inmates of the Utica State Lunatic Asylum from 1851 mm-hmm. to 1860 in mm-hmm. Utica, New York, was there were several different passages about what they called at the time fisting, which was forced feeding. They called it fisting because the staff would slam their fists into your mouth until you took the food in and swallowed it. And so this idea of how psychiatry handles what people want to put in their body or not, dates back at least to the 1850s in New York anyway. I'm sure it's before that in other places.
Right.
You know, but that I found. But that this is a long time issue of how, you know, and I've worked with people who have been forced onto feeding tubes and how over their objection, that was part of how they had to, you know, what part of what their mandated experience was, and that this historically has gone on. Yeah.
Precisely. And, you know, I felt, you know, I remember when I only had that feeding tube once, and eventually it was 3 a.m. one day, I just pulled the thing out, but when I had it put in, I said to myself, wait a minute, they are inserting an object, a foreign object, into an orifice of my body. If I object, I knew, you know, what were they going to call security? This is force.
Right.
This is force.
And so the comparison to rape is...
Of a foreign object. What is rape? Now, I don't know what it is in different states, but in Massachusetts, it's force of something into an orifice of the body. It doesn't have to be, you know, a male sexual organ. It can be an object. It can be an object. Do you see what I'm saying? That's what the feeding tube is. It's rape. It's rape. And unless it's something that somebody says, I want the feeding tube. I want the feeding tube. Please put it into me. It's rape.
Right.
If it's coerced, if it's, you know, if you know the security are going to come, it's rape. Let's face it.
And I think
many times they put it in, and the person is allergic to either the substance that the feeding tube is made of, for instance, latex, and they don't care, or the substance that they pour into so for instance, it's corn, or you know, sugar or corn syrup or you know modified whatever. It's not even food. It's not even food.
Right.
It's just a bunch of calories that they don't even care because insurance wants the person to gain weight as fast as possible.
It really is, and I think that this is part of what, you know, people are really battling with. And then you mentioned this before, but for anybody who didn't, like, make this deep connection here of the, like, the crimes that were really perpetrated against you, that because you had these problems or issues or whatever dealing with food and eating, that translated over to you being institutionalized over 50 times and electroshocked repeatedly with electro...
I also did time in a state hospital. Yeah, that too. I put that in my memoir, too, the whole ordeal in the state hospital. Yeah, I wasn't there very long, but... I put that in because it was back in the 80s that I was in the state hospital, but I kind of liked that chapter, there was that, and the whole book ends in I put the restraints part in the end too. The restraints part is in the end, even though that happened in 1983. But I put that in the end, too. It's quite something when you see a doctor say, put him in restraints, and walks off the ward. What power?
It really is something else.
But let's just say the forest through the trees. When you see psychiatry, when you see that the wizard is nothing but a guy behind a wall, you know, manipulating, you know, it's just a guy. It's just a guy. It's not really a wizard. It's just some guy, a humbug. Some guy probably from the home state of Kansas, just like Dorothy. You just know. It's not even real. It's just a guy writing scripts. He's just guessing. You know, I was diagnosed schizophrenic by a shrink that didn't have a license. He did it for convenience just to get me on disability. He had no license. His name was Charles Capers. He worked at Gould's firm. I was clued in this by someone clued me into this. He was practicing without a license to get caught. And they swept it under the rug, and he waltzed off to Texas. I don't know. He never got caught. It's off the record. It's off the record. But he was practicing without a license for years. They caught him. They fired him, hired this other guy, and swept it under the rug. The whole time he was prescribing with them for me, my parents were wondering, why isn't he checking her level? And they'd call him up at home and say, will you please do a lithium level on her? And they'd say, well, it's too much paperwork. And they were also wondering why I was screwing up the billing. And they call him up and say, we're being charged too much. And he'd say, oh, it's too much paperwork. Well, he was practicing without a license and prescribing willingly any old antipsychotic, even ones that were kind of off the market. And I'd go to the pharmacy and they'd say, well, this one isn't really on the market anymore. And I'd say, I don't know, he just wrote the script. I'm supposed to take it. What am I supposed to do? And they'd say, well, it's off the market now. Doesn't he know? And I'd say, I don't know.
just so many repeated examples of how this is a problem and how psychiatry is just a fraud.
It was so funny. I look back and I laugh now, but I don't know. They managed to sweep it under the rug and not let it be seen. But God bless the gal that hitchhiked out of that place. It was kind of like a concentration camp there, but we were supposed to think it was great. We were supposed to think it was healing, but it was more like a concentration camp. But anyway, I got a chapter on that in my book, too. And it's called The Farm, that chapter called The Farm. And This Hunger is Secret. It's called This Hunger is Secret. But you got to keep in mind, I was still fully brainwashed when I finished the book by mental health. You know, I thought when I submitted my thesis and graduated, I was just nearing my turnaround, because that happened really 2012. Well, that's when my light bulb went off. So I'd already been through the Seroquel weight gain, and my weight was already, it was coming down. You know, I was already pretty, very underweight, rather underweight. You know, when I graduated, I was rather starved. But I'd not yet seen eating disorders cure and the reality of all that. And my classmates were pretty worried about me when I was graduating, because I was really, really thin. My therapist was threatening to hospitalize me, so that was a little scary. The book was published in ebook form a year later, and then a couple of years later, it came out in paperback. It was my master's thesis.
Well, I'm going to open up a line here because there's been somebody on area code 484 who's been hanging on for a long time, and I just want to make sure that you didn't have any trouble getting through. Do you have a question or a comment for Julie? Okay, this person may just want to be listening. I just wanted to make sure that we weren't overlooking there. If you would like to talk, please press 1 or star 1. And if you'd like to call in, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, 855-346-3351. So, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the idea that this is a torture camp and...
it's torture.
And what did you call that chapter in And this Hungariest Secret is called The Farm?
That's the one about Gould's Farm. Yeah, that one is about Gould's Farm. I was there for 5.5 months in 1984. It's in Western Massachusetts. It's one of these so-called progressive treatment centers. I personally, what I remember of it, you know, I first got there, it only took a few days before I realized, wait a minute, you get there and then they hand you this paper that says you can't talk about anything while you're here. You're not allowed to talk about anything. And I'm like, whoops, what can I talk about? You couldn't talk about any of your, you could only talk about, people are only talking about what brand of cigarettes do you smoke. And that was the content of the conversation because it was like censorship.
Yeah, where they deemed what's appropriate to discuss, right?
The only appropriate discussion, basically. And why? Because it was like, okay, you can't talk about medications. You can't talk about suicide. You can't talk about medications. You can't talk about doctors. You can't talk about, you can't talk about that stuff. That's out of the question.
Right.
So, you see what that's leading to, So if this medication is giving you a very bad side effect, discussed. Yeah.
So anything that somebody might be interested in talking about, something that may be meaningful to them, that makes anybody else around them uncomfortable take some kind of action, then they censor it. I do want to say area code. Area code 216, your line is open. You're on the air.
Hello, Lauren.
Yes, I can.
This is John from Cleveland. I want to be brief because I don't have too many minutes left on my cell phone. I just want to make a brief comment. Things I've read that you posted on Facebook and other things I've read in your comments on the show, I really admire your radical view towards psychiatry because there are just so many of these reformers around and say, well, maybe we prescribe a little bit too much medication. Maybe we could just fix the system. I mean, that stuff is worse than death as far as I'm concerned. I very much admire your radical view towards it. But I just want to ask you, could you bring us up to date on the Murphy bill?
The most I have as far as all I know is that it did not pass, that Congress is out of session, I believe. The final, I believe they're done for right now, that people have been encouraged to reach out to their congresspeople during the Congress's break and go to town hall meetings, call your local congresspeople. Last I saw that it had either 95 or 200 Congress people supporting it, and it needs either 217 or 218 votes to pass. So it's I don't believe that it's happening now, but it still is something that we need to be very, very concerned about, and I'm sure that come as soon as session opens again, that they are going to go fast and strong in trying to get this pushed through.
And then in tech, they just don't give up. That's a scary stuff. Listening to Julie's talk with you, if you haven't read her book, This Hunger is Secret, it's very enjoyable. It's very moving. I recommend it.
I thank you, and I'm really enjoying Julie talking with you, and I'm looking through your websites and looking forward to this. But yeah, I mean, I think that we need people, everybody who can and who is willing to speak out, that this is the time, and that we are in such a dangerous time, because if the more things that like H.R. 3717 that pass or get, pushed in, under the cloak of night, as they've done many things before, the quicker our civil liberties are just going out the window, and that this fraud that psychiatry can answer anything will continue.
Well, the bill that you just referred to, that is different from the Murphy bill?
No, H.R. 3717, that's the Murphy bill.
Oh, okay. And that's what we should make sure that they don't reintroduce next time, or if they do reintroduce it, to be telling our congresspeople to vote against it.
Right, and also, I mean, it's probably never too early to start talking to your senators to let them know how you feel about this type of legislation in general, because if it's not that, something else will, inevitably, something is going to wind up at some point getting to the Senate, and so to have your senators briefed as much as possible and educated in our perspectives, or your perspectives, is really important. And I don't think that there's any large mainstream campaign that is really educating on an anti-psychiatry basis. I think the closest education that they're getting is, like you said, maybe we should, cut back or, reform. But I don't think that there's an abolition message that's getting to the Congress or the Senate unless individuals themselves are doing it. But I don't think on a national level we've put together a platform yet, and I really think we should.
Yes, I
want to ask something.
Yes.
I was wondering also, do you know, I think we should just have like a class action suit. Like some really big ones, really, really big ones. I just see too many, we've all seen too many people die from psychiatry. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's too many people die. When you see these psych patients die, it's not from the illness, it's from the treatment. There's a famous poem, and it was funny because when I first read it, it was a time when my weight was just going up, 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 and I didn't even think that, I wasn't thinking, but it's called something about, it's got the name Ellen West in it. It's by Frank Bidart. It's about a woman with anorexia who's forced into anorexia treatment a long time ago. Her name's Ellen West, and the poem is by Frank Bidart. In fact, I studied it. I studied the poem in a graduate course, and I can't remember the name of the poem, but it's something, 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 Ellen West. It's his most, one of his most famous poems, and I don't know why particular he chose her life to write about, but it's a famous poem, and it's about how he's forced into anorexia treatment, she comes out, and she kills herself. Why? Not because of anorexia, but because she's forced into the treatment. And it was written quite some time ago. It's written quite some time ago. I think somebody should stick that poem up and just expose these people for who they are. And not just eating disorders treatment, but all mental health treatment. It's very, very revealing because it's not the illness, it's the treatment. It's the treatment. It's a dehumanizing treatment. You go into these places, they tell you how stupid you are, what an idiot you are, how needy you are when you aren't, how you need them so much, how you can't live without them. Come to staff if you need anything. What a myth. What a myth.
Right, and it sets people up to believe that, and people live out sometimes.
I'm so needy. I got a need for life. Yeah, sure.
It really, and I do agree. I mean, obviously, there's these real, very physical, grave bodily injury and death that is potential from the products and procedures of psychiatry, but there's also this very big psychological impact, the negative long-term consequences of the messaging of psychiatry.
The message is very damaging, and I've had people argue with me, oh my God, no, it's not true, I have a terrible disease, and I'm terribly sick with this. Don't you understand? It's real. I don't doubt. I don't doubt for 1 minute because I've been through it. I've been through terrible depression. Of course I have. I have tried to kill myself. Of course, yes, I have. I've been through all that. I've been through all that, and I don't doubt it for 1 minute. I don't deny it for 1 minute. I deny mental health care. I deny therapy. I will not go to a therapist. I will not prostitute myself before a therapist because I don't think that is the right way. I don't think that that concept is that the concept is just all screwed up. You know, it's
plus they're not at all trustable. They're not in any way trustable, because even if you've got somebody who you think is going to, like, really listen to you, but they then are, you know, has been discussed on the show by several people, you know, are now the new law enforcement and are there to turn you in and testify against you in court.
Right.
And so how can you in any way trust these people? And, you know, things that the Murphy bill... and Tom, thanks for calling in, John, about the Murphy bill. I think it's, you know, these are the exact kind of things that they're setting up more and more of instead of shutting these people down and taking these kinds of things away.
Precisely. And another thing is that the whole concept of it being not right, because you are then know that you have the safety net. And even the concept of this anonymous call-in line that you can call in when you are suicidal, that takes away the friendship. Because now, suddenly, it implies suicide is taboo, so you have this magic call-in line that you can call in. So now, that implies that you can't talk, don't talk about suicide with your friends, because you can talk about suicide with us instead. But you only got 10 minutes because we're going to cut you off.
Yeah,
they cut you
right.
off after 2 minutes. They give you the 8-minute warning, the 9-minute warning, and then click, they cut you off. They cut you off. And guess what? You got to be qualified for the suicide hotline. You got to be really suicidal, otherwise you don't qualify. When you reject it from a suicide hotline because it's 3 o'clock in the morning and there ain't no friends around, either you don't got none or they're all asleep, you don't qualify for this anonymous suicide hotline. Tell me if that ain't rejection. But anyway, the fact that the suicide hotline is there is that safety net that's gonna call you. They're gonna section you anyway. That concept of that is not correct. You should be able to call your friends. Talking about suicide should be blown wide to bits. It should be okay to talk about suicide. In fact, it should be okay. They shouldn't lock up people that talk about suicide. You should be able to talk about it to anybody. And you shouldn't be defriended for talking about suicide or called sick or wrong. It's a normal part of growing up to think about it. It's a normal part of living and dying and breathing and thinking. It's a normal part to think about suicide and change your mind. And 10 minutes later, think about life and death. You should think about life and death. Everybody should. It's about time. As soon as you hit 50, you should think about life and death. If you smoke, the minute you pick up a cigarette, you should think about death. Everybody should.
There's such a skewed vision of what again can and can't be talked about. That if somebody's talking about it, then we need to, like, quick and call the cops and have them locked up because, you know, they'll be quote-unquote safe, and more likely to be subjected to electroshock and drugs and restraints and seclusion and all these things that are known
to
kill. So we really do need to... Yeah, just continue breaking down that wall and beating it until it drops.
Another myth is the myth of Yeah, go ahead. I lost it.
Oh, that's okay. No, I mean, I think, well, that's, you know, the myth that if you talk about it, that it's going to cause it. Like, you know,
you want to talk about
magical thinking. you know what I mean? Like, words don't equate, and that these are real feelings that people have, and those feelings should be really respected and responded to. And the response doesn't have to be locking somebody up and making them feel like they're less than a person. The response can be just, you know, listening and helping somebody figure out what they want and what their next steps are going to be and whether or not they're going to be ready to get to a point of healing. You know, when especially like when dealing with trauma, you know, sometimes it's just about starting a conversation. Just being there, and not fixing it, not solving anything, not having any answers, just being. I think that that's one of the things that's stolen from us.
It's stolen, yeah. That was the other thing I was thinking about. Bodies. Aren't people allowed to talk about bodies? And especially, like, with eating disorder treatment, they shut it down immediately. They tell you you're supposed to censor your thoughts. Now, people immediately, of course, censor their thoughts going around. It's like you become your own thought police. And you can't talk about, they tell you you can't talk about this, that, and the other thing. And you're very heavily censored in this eating disorders treatment, worse than Gould's Farm ever was. So you can't talk about, oh, my God, the stuff you can't talk about. They listen on to your conversations and they tell you to shut up all the time. And you can't talk about food and anything. You can't say any numbers whatsoever. Even, you know, you can't say any numbers. Like, I can't say that my dog is 6 kilos. I couldn't say that to anybody. I can't. That would be totally taboo. I couldn't say cancer. That was taboo. I once said that word, cancer, and they say, oh, you can't say that, Julie. It's going to trigger people. They're so afraid of that. It's like paranoia or something. You can't, there's so many, anything that's halfway going to trigger people is going to upset people. Oh, my God, it's going to upset people. You can't say. And there's so much of that. But I think, let's blow it wide. That's a myth. I mean, we need to, like, dispel that because here's a scene. I'm going to give you a scene. I'm going to be a writer for sec. Here's a scene. Kids at summer camp. I remember sitting at summer camp. I don't know how old I was because I don't remember. I went to a few years of summer camp. We sat around in a circle, a bunch of us. We took off our clothes, a few of them. I don't remember how much clothes, but a bunch of clothes. And we looked at our bodies. No, I didn't have an eating disorder at the time. It didn't hit me till 22, so I didn't have an eating disorder. But we sat around, and we looked at our bodies. We were all girls, and we looked at them. Now, we didn't have bodies that were alike. We didn't have bodies that were alike. Why? Because we were human. We were human. And we looked at our toes. We looked at our hands. We looked at our elbows. We looked at our hair and our noses and our little moles on our bodies and our teeth. And you know, this girl had webbed toes. She had webbed toes, and she showed them to us. We were fascinated. It wasn't a defect. It was cool. It was cool that she had these toes that were kind of stuck together. We thought it was the coolest thing. And another girl showed us her elbows turned inside out. I said, hey, my mom can do that too. And then we looked at our belly buttons. They were all different. Every single belly button was different. Every single belly button was different. We looked at them. We looked at them, and that was cool. And we started looking, and, you know, some girls had little birthmarks and stuff, and that was cool, too. And we looked at everything on our bodies, all the cool stuff, and the cool little things we could do. Some girls could do cool things with their hands, turn their fingers inside out and snap them funny, and some girls could do things, and, you know, I knew kids that could hit baseball bats, and some kids could do funny things, and some kids could pop pop wheelies on their bikes, and some kids could do math cool, and some kids could do all kinds of abilities. And
amazing. We really are all unique.
Kids are all different. We're all unique. And you know, my aunt had a hearing aid. You could put that hearing aid in your ear, and you could hear across the world. You could hear across the world. Us kids would get in the room. We could put that hearing aid ear in our ears, and we could hear the grown-ups speaking in Yiddish. Now that was another world, wasn't it? And those girls at summer camp, you know, would skip rope and stuff, and would, you know, why isn't eating disorders care like that? Why isn't eating disorders care like that? Why don't we compare? Because we're not, we're told we can't compare. Why don't we find the beautiful things in our bodies? Why don't we find what's beautiful and special and unique about ourselves?
I think that's one of the biggest problems, right? And all beyond whatever anybody's particular struggle is, that why do we prevent ourselves from that?
Why not talk about it? Why not talk about it? Why not look at our bodies in a new and very special and different way? Because we're all so special. We can do it. We can do it. Why not look at food in a very new, special way? Food is beautiful. It really is. It's so colorful, and it's funny looking. I was at a store, a vegetable store. It's not really a store. It's like a farm stand. This lady goes, and she goes and gets it off the farms. And we looked at a carrot today, and I don't know if I still have it. I might have eaten it. I don't know how you say it. The H is like not said. But anyway, Zonaria, I think it said. But anyway, I don't know if you even said the Z as a Z, but I got to learn it. But anyway, that's how it said. That's the word for carrot. How did they get that from carrot? I don't know. But it's orange anyway. It was three. It had three fingers to it. And she speaks Spanish, and I don't, but I was taking it through the conversation, and I showed my three fingers, and she showed me the three-fingered carrot, and that was the one I bought. Now, that's beautiful, isn't it? A three-fingered carrot, and I bought the two-fingered carrot as well.
Well, you lost me a little there, to be honest, Julie, but I think...
No. Three fingers, it was a root. It's a root vegetable with three fingers on it.
Okay.
But food is beautiful. It's fun. It's colorful, and it tastes good. And you forget all of that when you get an eating disorder. You forget it all. And it can be used to heal you. It doesn't have to be punishment.
I see.
It just doesn't. You know, it doesn't have to be punishment. And, you know, it doesn't. I don't know, all that gets forgotten.
Well, I think that there are people who are listening who are going to know exactly what you're talking about, and that's what's important.
Yeah.
I think that it's really important. And I think to be able to talk about these things, and that not everything has to make sense. Not everything has to be understood by everybody. And some things just need to be said, and that they're understood by those who they're meant for. On some levels, I feel like psychiatry and mental health, practitioners are such control freaks in needing to understand everything and be able to... have a box to put everything into, that if they're listening to something that they don't understand, they immediately freak out and try to shut it down. Instead of just saying, like,
If a psychiatrist heard me talk about a three-fingered carrot, they say I was delusional, but I don't know, I should have snapped a picture of it, because the carrot really did have three fingers. The carrot really did. It was a root that was divided into three. It was divided into three.
I got it. Wait,
three.
Yeah, the second time around I got it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can see it. I got a little lost
there
for a
moment. Let me look at my bag and see if it's still here. Let me look if it's still here. I think I still have it. Let me see. I'll snap a picture and send it to you.
But I think that these are the important issues that nobody really wants to grapple with.
Yes, I'll send it to you. I still got the three-fingered carrots right here. I'm holding it.
Oh, great! If you tag me in it, I'll put it up on the Talk with Tenny page on Facebook.
I will. It's a three-fingered carrot.
I think that we have to, as a society, really question what it is we're doing, why we're doing it, and if we're just continuing this, faith in psychiatry because that's what we've always done and we've always been fooled by this system, then we really need, as a society, to start holding society accountable for this fraud also. And so in 2014... Yeah. With the internet and all the access to information, there is no reason why anybody who has any kind of power inside of the psychiatric, system or whatever, there's no reason for them to not know the serious damage that psychiatry causes, and to not have some kind of major disclaimer around any psychiatric intervention that this may shorten your lifespan. This may kill you. This may cause you more problems. I think that's what we really need to be aiming for.
Yeah, I would encourage, if anybody out there has an eating disorder and is wondering, well, gee, should I go to a therapist or not? Don't walk into mental health. Go. See somebody that isn't a mental health practitioner. Try not to just avoid them like the plague. Don't see, I would just stay away from mental health at all costs. These eating disorders therapists, I would stay away from them. I would stay away from them. If they're mental health professionals, I would not go to them. And, if they have a mental health degree, no, I wouldn't go to them. I would go to a non-traditional nutritionist, a naturopath, go to acupuncture, somebody that isn't a mandated reporter, do yoga, anything.
Right.
But,
and I'm just, Julie,
anything
I'm just wondering,
but mental health.
We have only a small amount of time left. I'm just wondering, the eatingdisordersrescue.com, is that site?
Yeah, that site I haven't developed too much, but one of the pieces in there that I did, it's on Vimeo, is a tribute to my voice teacher. A lot of it is about my voice teacher. It's kind of a memoir piece that I did. About my voice teacher, it's an old piece I did in the spring of 2013. If anybody is interested in that, that's up there. It's on there. His name was Frank Baker. I think he died in 2000 some odd. He was like in his 90s.
Okay,
yes.
And what's the
they're
best
on that site.
What's the best website for them to for people to find information about
probably
you?
Probably my blog, juliemadlogger.wordpress.com is the most up to date on what I'm up to.
Okay.
That's the most up to date, and you can get a link to my book from there. That's the most up to date. JulieGreen.name it's got excerpts from my book on there, but it's not up to date. Like I said, my kidneys failed a year ago, and since then, I've been really, really, it's been really hard for me to keep up with stuff, really, really hard, and everything's kind of scattered, and as I said, I just, walked out of my prior home. I left a lot of stuff behind, a lot of my paper records. are in storage, and I'm here with, you know, just a very few of my belongings, and it's been very hard for me to stay organized the past 3 years because I've been dealing with insomnia from the drugging, so it's kind of hard. I conk out very, very easily, and you know, because I'm really, really, really tired. I'm really tired all the time.
Right.
I'm really tired.
Well,
I'm trying to deal with that right now.
That's, yeah, I mean, that's definitely, and I hope that you have a speedy recovery and have,
yeah, thanks.
You know,
yeah,
good health and energy.
I'm working on it. Just trying to find some answer to the fact that I don't sleep. And what I'm finding out, I finally found out that pretty much across the board, everybody who was drugged as much as I was, I think it's pretty much anything that's sedating, the mind gets used to the sedation, and then you just can't sleep after a while. You need more and more sedation, and you just can't sleep. And that's what's happened to me, and thousands of people are now experiencing the insomnia. They can't sleep. They
right,
can't
millions.
Sleep.
Yeah. Sure.
Is it in the millions? Is it in the millions?
Oh, well, over time, over time, I'm sure it is. Because they're selling millions of prescriptions, right?
Out.
They're writing millions of prescriptions a year. So those millions of prescriptions.
I'm getting 1 hour of sleep. And I knew, it hit me like a brick wall. And it's been 3 years now of 1 hour of sleep. And I just conk out. I literally conk out. I'll be sitting there and I just collapse. And so I'm incredibly fatigued all the time, 24/7. And, my kidneys are running at 1/3 because of lithium. But it's not just that. It's very bad insomnia. And, you know, that's my number one. That's my number one challenge right now is insomnia, you know, because, if I can solve that, I'll be able to function much, much better, much better. But, trying to solve that I want to find out what precisely did these drugs do? What damage did they do? And if I can find out what they did, then I can properly correct it instead of try this, try that, try this, try that. Because there's, thousands of things you can try that, trying that.
Right, and unfortunately, they do plenty of damage, and so.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well, I just really want to thank you for calling in tonight and spending all this time and talking to us about
thank
all these.
Thank you so much. And people can contact me through my blog or, there's a link on there to contact me. You can give me a call. My phone number does go automatically into voicemail. I get a heck of a lot of spam. If you leave your email address or your phone number, there's a space where you can leave your email address. If you leave a message on my phone, I think there's a place where you can phone me. Just speak your phone number clearly so that it goes through. I don't know if you can still phone me or not, but if you leave me your email address, that would be great. Because I'd love to get an email. I am going to be getting off Facebook shortly because I can't stay TV and stuff anymore. And the defriending is stuck.
Well, I do think that's great. That people can contact you is great. And it's juliamadblogger.wordpress.net. And I think we might be having a little bit of technical difficulty, but I want to again thank Julie for coming on and spending so much time tonight. And I do believe that the website is juliemadblogger.wordpress.net. juliemadblogger.wordpress.com. juliemadblogger.wordpress.com, and I will put that up. Julie, I hope that you're good, and I will look forward to speaking with you again soon. And please, when you have updates, when your new book comes out, do get in touch. Just a reminder that there will be some upcoming shows getting organized in the coming weeks, a series on human rights and other shows. If you have an idea for a show or a tip or know of a human rights violation that you would like to have exposed, please call the Talk with Tenny tip line, 718-273-8708. I want to thank you all for listening in, and Julie for speaking out, and Tom for calling in. I'm going to ask you to keep on speaking out until I talk to you next time. Talk to you soon. Good night, everybody.